This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we'll explore long-haul COVID, people suffering with symptoms like exhaustion, loss of taste, and neurological conditions, suffering for months after diagnosis a bit later. But first, physicists have confirmed an unexplainable behavior of an elementary particle first noticed 20 years ago. Experiments at Fermilab in Batavia, Illinois, showed that a certain subatomic particle called a muon disobeys the laws of physics as scientists have written them. And whenever stuff appears to be breaking the law in science, it's a big deal. Here to help explain the story and other science news of the week is my guest, Roxane Camzy, science journalist based in Montreal, Quebec. Welcome to Science Friday. Nice to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
You know, Chris Polly, a physicist at Fermilab, called this discovery their, quote, Mars rover landing moment. So this is a big deal.
Yeah. And what I love about this is it's physicists getting excited when something is a little bit unexpected and kind of wrong per their predictions. So I think that it's really cool in that way.
Yeah. Walk us through what actually was unexplainable.
Sure. So as you said, muons are these particles, and they're actually known as fat electrons, which I think is interesting because they're 200 times as massive as electrons, which is a particle a lot of people know. And what they did is that they exposed these muons to an intense magnetic field. And when that happened, the muons did some wobbling like a spinning top. But they did it in a manner that wasn't quite consistent with what the physicists had calculated would happen. So they got all excited because there was this fluke and that could actually inform them to tell them how their equations about, you know, how the universe and matter operate are off. So it's actually helping nudge them towards more correct equations that could explain more of the universe.
You know, this is the second announcement in the last 2 weeks. I mean, we talked about this last week on Science Friday, of a different unexplainable behavior of an elementary particle. Last week, we talked about muons and electrons. Shouldn't be surprising, I guess, if we don't know what 96% of the universe is made of, dark energy and dark matter, there should be a lot of surprises out there.
I know. It makes biology look kind of stable by comparison when you talk about physics. So, I mean, for sure. And I think that the statistics here matter as well, because according to these measurements, there is a 1 in 40,000 chance that this was just a statistical anomaly, that it was a fluke, and, you know, that it didn't really happen in a way. And physicists are a really precise bunch. 1 in 40,000 to them is not quite sufficient to satisfy them.
Not good enough.
It's not good enough. You know, they want it to be a lower probability. So they're going to keep pursuing this and see if they can make themselves more sure.
All right. Speaking of pursuing, let's move on to some strange physiology news. It turns out if you participate in certain activities, your heart can shrink. Tell us about that.
It's true. So, you know, we often think about endurance swimmers and astronauts as people who are getting stronger and more robust through these activities. But scientists, they wanted to know what would happen when astronauts go into space, because astronauts are spending obviously a lot of time there, and we might end up in space more often. So they looked at Scott Kelly's heart, and you might know Scott Kelly because he was a former astronaut and now he's in the Senate. But he spent 340 days aboard the International Space Station, which is a really long time. It's almost a year. So they compared his heart with that of an endurance swimmer, Benoît Lecomte.
And what did they find?
So what they found was so interesting. So Benoît Lecomte spent a long time swimming across the Pacific Ocean. He'd hoped to cross it. So he spent between 9 and 17 hours each day swimming or sleeping, basically not subjected to gravity in the way that normally we are when we're walking around. And they looked at his heart and they compared it to Captain Kelly's, who's was obviously floating around a lot in space. And so they were really trying to understand how gravity affects heart function. And they found that actually their hearts atrophied a little bit, which is a little sad.
Ooh, yeah, I mean, that's bad. You got to have heart, as the song goes. Does the heart go back to normal after some period of time?
It does. So they lost about 20% of the total mass in their left ventricles. And what happened was, and the reason for that is that over time, the heart wasn't working as hard. So the muscle kind of atrophies, kind of like my legs during this, you know, lockdown pandemic period. I definitely don't have the leg strength I used to.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But Ira, thankfully, after they got back on terra firma, they had a rebound of their heart mass. So that's a kind of positive outcome of the end.
That's good. That's good. Let's move on to a story that you wrote for the New York Times called The Mysterious Aftermath of Infections. I mean, we're going to be talking about long COVID later this hour, but in your article, you say lasting effects of infections are nothing new. Where have we seen this before?
So, yeah, we've been seeing this for a long time. In this op-ed, I tried to walk people through all the examples that have accumulated over the years. I don't know if you've ever had strep throat.
Oh, yeah, I think just about everybody has. It's quite common.
Yeah, so luckily these days we have antibiotics that can treat it. But if you don't treat strep throat, it's been known for you know, many decades, and you know, maybe even perhaps longer, that you can have damage to your heart even after that sore throat's gone and you feel that the acute infection has passed.
Yeah, I think your valves, the heart valves, I think can get involved in this. Yeah,
I mean, all sorts of things can go wrong. And similarly, with H. pylori, which is this bacteria that can infect your stomach, if that hangs around too long, you can get ulcers and stomach cancer. HPV, the human papillomavirus, can also cause throat cancer. And, you know, you can also get this effect after infections called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a paralysis. All these kinds of infections cause these aftershocks that we don't really think about viruses as causing cancer, but they can, or bacteria is causing ulcers. But all of these things are happening. So what research really has to do is figure out how these infections are causing these long-term aftermaths, especially, as you know, because of COVID, we're seeing that this isn't just, you know, one or two infections. It's a lot of different ones.
Yeah, it's a whole spectrum. As I said, we're going to be talking about long COVID later in the hour. Let's move on to some climate news. Our weather forecasts are going to change next month? Are you forecasting that, or is that what's going to happen?
It is actually going to happen. So the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which is also known as NOAA, which is one of my favorite administrations because I'm a little weather obsessed myself. So once in a decade, they release what is known as their climate normals. And that is basically, they look at a 30-year average. So, you know, today, when they are talking about their averages, they're looking at 1981 to 2010. But come May 4th, they're going to update that so that they're looking at a different 30-year period. They're going to look at 1991 to 2020. And that's significant because the decade 2011 to 2020 was one of the hottest on record in the U.S. And globally, it was the hottest decade since 1880. So all of a sudden, the averages that we're going to be comparing our current weather to is a higher average, and that has all sorts of implications.
Yeah. What do you mean? Give me an idea of what kind of implications we're talking about.
Sure. So if you're, let's say, in the West Coast, which is actually one of the areas that saw a substantial upward trend in temperature, your forecaster on the news is going to be saying, you know, we're going to have a cooler than normal day. But that cooler than normal day is actually compared to a normal that's hotter. So if they tell you it's cooler than normal now, it's going to feel cooler than in a month from now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I do remember a few years ago, and this was exactly the kind of thing you're talking about. It's so hot in Australia now in the summertime that they had to add another color to their weather map. They had to add like a deep purple because the weather in Fahrenheit degrees was getting up, you know, 110 or hotter, and they just didn't know how to show that on the map, so they had to change the color of the map.
Yeah, I mean, it's we're going to have to kind of reframe our thinking in terms of what is normal, and that's kind of a little concerning given the trends. I know there are all sorts of other things that might be harder you have to take into account, so I want to say it's a mixed bag, but it's more even complicated than that. We're going to have to see what it feels like to live in this new climate normal.
Yeah. And one last story to talk about involves yawning and lions. What's going on here?
Well, I hope that no one is yawning as they're listening to me talk, but I find yawning perennially fascinating. All the more so because we don't really know what's going on when people yawn. So scientists tried to get a clue into the function of yawning by looking at lions, which I think have the most glamorous yawn of like any animal out there. So over 4 months in 2019, they monitored 19 lions in South Africa at the Greater Makalali Private Game Reserve. And they noticed that when a lion caught another yawn from a lion, they were 11 times more likely to mimic the movements of that yawning lion than if they were just hanging around a non-yawning lion. So I think what the scientists say is that this is the first time that anyone has tried to quantify how yawning helps coordinate collective behavior. So yawning might be functioning not just to look glamorous if you're a lion, but actually to coordinate some kind of social collective behavior. I think that's really cool.
You know, that is cool. And it might explain or back up, you know, we say yawning is contagious, right? If you're in a group of people and one person starts to yawn, then everybody seems to start to yawn. It seems to be happening with lions also.
Yes. And actually, as you say that, I'm thinking, thank God it's like not harmful because we're talking about so many contagious things these days. But yes, like, yeah, it has this potential greater function. And I think it's really cool that lions are giving us a clue into that. I'd love to know more if other animals kind of coordinate their behavior. And you know, this research is nothing to yawn at, if you ask me.
Ooh, and maybe we could have that MGM lion now yawning at the beginning of a movie, but that may send the wrong signal, I think. Yeah.
Yes, and what is a yawn versus a roar when you really think about it? I mean, they might be more related than we think.
And there you have it. Roxane Kamsi, science journalist based in Montreal. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about how Punjabi Sikh truck drivers in California have been navigating the pandemic. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later, we'll talk about long-haul COVID and what treatment options are out there. But now, it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
Iowa Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. During the pandemic, there's been a lot of talk about the safety of essential workers, people who keep the infrastructure and basic operations of the country going for the rest of us. One group designated as essential workers was truck drivers. In California, Punjabi Sikhs, or some people pronounce it Sikhs, from that northern Indian region, make up a large part of the trucking workforce. According to the North American Punjabi Trucking Association, Punjabi Sikhs make up 40% of the trucking workforce in California and 20% nationally. But navigating COVID information and resources for Sikh truckers has been a challenge. Kerry Klein is here to fill us in on this story. She's a reporter at Valley Public Radio in Fresno, California. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ira.
Let's talk about this. In California, truckers were deemed essential workers. Did this translate into more resources or vaccine priority?
No, it has not, at least not yet. You know, early on when the vaccine itself first came out in California, you know, there was this statewide list of vaccine priority. They had these tiers by occupation, starting with healthcare workers, teachers. Transportation workers were originally just a few tiers down in that list. But in January, Governor Newsom shifted this all to be a priority system based on age and medical vulnerability, leaving truckers to wait their turn along with all the rest of us. So that, you know, that's for the vaccine. But then also health agencies at the state and with various counties have provided very little information about COVID-19 in these truckers' native language of Punjabi, you know, leaving them also feeling a little bit left behind in all of this.
Yeah, I know in your story, as you covered this issue, you spoke to Punjabi Sikh truck drivers. How are they feeling about the resources that were available to them? What were the main issues? Was it that no one was communicating with them?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the biggest issues. And I shouldn't say that no one, you know, a lot of health agencies, they might make a couple of documents or a couple of fact sheets available in Punjabi. But, you know, like the rest of us who speak English and sometimes Spanish, you know, we have these data dashboards, we have these registration pages for testing and for vaccines. And a lot of these things are not made available in Punjabi. And so it can be very difficult to navigate, get access to resources, and get these ever-changing resources and regulations and policies directly from the health agencies. And that was kind of leaving a lot of other organizations to step in and fill in these information gaps.
You spoke with Rajkaranbir Singh, who is an announcer and engineer with Punjabi Radio USA. And this is what he had to say.
I know people can argue, okay, they need to know English. Okay, they need to know English, but how are they reaching out? There is no outreach to them. Even the health officials or the departments, they are not contacting us.
Kerry, is that what you found?
Yeah, what Singh is saying there is that, you know, his radio station, Punjabi Radio USA, they have an incredible reach. You know, they have these brick and mortar radio stations that broadcast locally, but they also have these internet streams that reach people and truckers, especially around the country. And he's saying we have this incredible network reaching these essential workers, and yet health agencies are not contacting us to actually, you know, do outreach to them. And he was really frustrated by kind of his community being left in the dark. But that being said, recently, in the last month or so, a lot of that has been changing. So the state did contact his station to set up a vaccine campaign in Punjabi. And then some counties also have been, Fresno County particularly, has been scheduling vaccine clinics at Sikh temples. And other organizations are beginning to get contacted by health agencies to do these Punjabi campaigns around the state.
This lack of information has been an issue for the wider Punjabi-speaking community. There were Punjabi organizations, right, that stepped in to fill in the information gaps. What were some of those campaigns like?
Yeah, well, so one of them is this Punjabi Radio USA that we already talked about. During the pandemic, they really doubled their news content and did a lot of call-in shows that have been specifically about COVID. And a lot of truck drivers especially have told me that this is where they got their daily news is from this radio station. But there's also another organization known as the Jakara Movement. It's a nonprofit here in California. They've translated a lot of information. They've gone out to Sikh temples to help register people for tests and vaccines. And they've also put out, you know, culturally sensitive graphics for things like how to wear a mask over a turban and showing, you know, elderly people in traditional clothing getting their vaccines to promote people who look like them in this community being reached by pandemic information.
The San Joaquin Valley is southeast of San Francisco. How has the pandemic affected that area?
Well, we've been, by a lot of measures of the pandemic, we have been hit harder than the rest of the state. We were, along with the Los Angeles area, we were the first region to go into regional lockdowns last fall. Our hospital ICUs were at capacity for a month during the winter surge. We've lagged behind the rest of the state in improving and in reopening. That being said, however, California is actually right now doing very well compared to the rest of the country, and that includes our region as well.
Thank you, Kerry. Great information. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
You're welcome.
Kerry Klein, a reporter for Valley Public Radio in Fresno, California. You can read her full report. It's up on our website, sciencefriday.com/stateofscience. This far into the pandemic, those who haven't gotten COVID-19 have been lucky or careful, because there's something strange happening with some people who've gotten sick and are left with long-lasting complications. These patients are being called COVID long haulers, and it's estimated that somewhere between 10 and 30% of people who get COVID are stuck with lasting effects. We asked our listeners on our Sci-Fry Vox Pop app to tell us their experiences with long COVID.
I started showing COVID-19 symptoms back at the beginning of November 2020, and I had flu-like symptoms for a couple of weeks, and it cleared up. About a week into the experience, I lost my taste and smell. My taste has slowly come back, but it's now March 2021, and I still can't smell anything.
I got COVID-19 in December. It affected my legs mostly, which are getting much better, but I'm not back to the way I was.
I had COVID in December and I went down really hard. I still don't have my sense of smell completely back. My taste is still altered. I'm foggy all the time mentally, and I consider it a really, really good day if I don't have to take a nap in the middle of lunch. So I want to know if this is going to be my new reality forever.
Thanks to Michael from Kansas City, Cynthia from Massachusetts, and Catherine from Chicago for sharing their stories. Long-haul COVID is still a mystery in a lot of ways, but there is a lot of work being done to understand it better, and that's what we're going to be talking about with my guests. Dr. Walter Karaschetz is director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda. Dr. David Petrino, director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. David, let me begin with you. Foggy head, loss of taste, smell, limbs not working as well. Are these all typical long-haul symptoms?
Yeah, these are symptoms that sound really familiar to me. We've been tracking this for quite some time now, and some of the most common symptoms that we'll see in this syndrome is cognitive difficulties are present in about 80% of our cohort, headache, chest pain, shortness of breath, sort of high heart rate and feeling like the heart is beating rapidly in the chest, exercise intolerance, and extreme fatigue. These are some of the cardinal symptoms that we're seeing in roughly 80% of the population.
You know, we say when you have COVID, you have typical symptoms, but there are so many symptoms here. Could it be almost anything?
Yeah, so far we've been tracking over 60 distinct symptoms, and they really do run across the entire body. They're multi-organ, they're multi-system. It can be really baffling to try and track everything that we're seeing. This is why we've started looking toward systems of the body, such as the autonomic nervous system, because the autonomic nervous system can really control lots of things, highly diverse things across the entire body. And it makes some sort of sense when in the context of these symptoms.
Autonomic nervous system means, for our listeners,
the autonomic nervous system is a portion of your nervous system that controls all of the things in your body that you don't ordinarily need to think about controlling, such as when to breathe in and when to breathe out, when your heart should contract and relax, digestion, you know, when your hair should stand on end, and, you know, body temperature. So it's a very diverse system, and ordinarily it doesn't require any conscious effort to control. But if it gets knocked out of balance, it can cause all sorts of very unusual symptoms.
At what point did it become clear that there was something strange going on with regard to long-term effects of COVID?
Well, for us, it was around late April, early May of 2020. We had been using an app to monitor acute symptoms and provide at-home care for people with acute cases of COVID that were not being hospitalized. And we had been running this app from about March of 2020. So by the time we hit late April, early May, we had around 800 people on the platform, and around 10% of the earliest adopters of the app were starting to express concerns about new symptoms that were emerging. And they just really weren't getting better. You know, they'd been on the app. Most people would get on the app and after about 5 weeks, they'd be discharged and thank us and say goodbye. But these people were starting to linger for 2 or 3 months. And all of these symptoms that they were talking about weren't the classic acute COVID symptoms. So at that point, we really started to notice that we were seeing what looked like a post-viral syndrome.
Interesting. Dr. Karaschetz, I want to ask you about this new study that's getting a lot of attention. Researchers found that in the U.S., a third of the people who had COVID developed a psychological or neurological condition within 6 months. This is pretty shocking, is it not?
Yes, I think most of the groups, and David could talk to this, are seeing anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder-like symptoms, usually on top of the more somatic symptoms that he mentioned. And that, I think, is to be expected. Now, the big question is there something that has affected the brain in COVID and the post-COVID period that is also contributing to these difficulties, particularly with concentration, memory, And that goes along heavily with fatigue. I think David mentioned that. And the studies are showing, yes, that these folks, when they're tested, are not performing as you would have expected in terms of their cognitive abilities. And they're telling you that because their main complaint is, you know, they go back to work and they just can't work at that normal level that they did before. Some of them can't go to work. I would say that what should be mentioned is that, you know, in COVID, when you go into that severe stage and you're in the hospital and then you maybe go into the intensive care unit and you have what's called acute respiratory distress syndrome, we know that people who have acute respiratory distress syndrome, COVID or no COVID, have long recovery periods and they have a lot of these symptoms that David mentioned. The surprise here with COVID is that many of the people who are suffering these complaints have never been in the hospital. So the CDC did a report out in July looking at non-hospitalized patients, and 35% of them had not returned to baseline health 2 to 3 weeks after their test was positive. And if that was influenza, one would have expected 90% would have been recovered by that time point. And so we really kind of need to get at the bottom of this. And NIH has really ambitious plans to do that. We call it the post-acute sequelae of COVID. It's a very boring technical term, but it kind of meets what it is, says what it is. And so we are going to develop a national program to follow people who have COVID, try and understand, you know, what is the recovery normally in people who recover quickly and how does that differ in people who recover more slowly. And then also to study the people who have persistent symptoms now months out and try and understand what is the biological base of those symptoms, what can we do to kind of alleviate the symptoms and get people healthier again. And the last bit that we really have to understand, which is a little bit off the topic but not entirely, is the fact that COVID has infected so many millions of people that we need to look and see, does it really affect your risk of developing other disorders in the future? Alzheimer's, cardiac disease, for instance. So that's kind of the gist of what the NIH programs are going to go after.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. It seems like you really do need a centralized center there at NIH because it takes in all the different divisions. You have infectious disease, you have neurological, you have all these others, aging. Is that what you're talking about? Are you going to create sort of a new mini division at NIH to study this?
Well, what we're going to create is actually a multi-institute program, which is part of it within NIH itself, but most of it will be out in the university settings or in the community settings. So we envision a large data center where all the data, the imaging data, the blood test data, the genomic data, all flow into this one data center where people will be able to go in and look for associations, a coordinating center that will coordinate all the activities of these multiple different cohorts.
Walter, it's clear that there are a lot of people out there suffering from long COVID symptoms. Many of them are people you deal with. We've heard from a lot of them on our Science Friday Vox Pop app, so I'd like to bring them into the picture from people who are actually suffering from them. Here's a question from Annie in Southern California about one symptom that seems pretty common.
Is there any cures for the lack of smell, which affects your taste?
Right. So the loss of smell is, we think, due to the fact that the virus infects the nasal epithelium, so the surface of your nose, inside your nose. And there are nerve cells there that detect odors and send the signals back into the brain. The good news is the best evidence is that the virus does not affect the nerve cells themselves, but the supporting cells around those nerve cells. And all those cells can regenerate. So the hope is, and this is the expectation, that these cells will be able to regenerate and your sense of smell will come back again. Couldn't guarantee it'll be exactly as it was, but in general, in similar conditions, that's what you see. You need to wait until the regeneration occurs before you get your sense of smell back.
We have to take a quick break, but we will continue our conversation about COVID long haulers when we come back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're continuing our conversation about COVID long haulers, people dealing with health effects months after infection. Here are my guests, Dr. Walter Karaschetz, Director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda, Maryland, Dr. David Petrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System here in New York City. Let me go to our next message, this one from Amy in Portland, Oregon. Amy was actually the person who coined the term COVID long haulers a year ago. You can read her story in a Wall Street Journal article from January 1st. Here's what Amy had to say.
What I want to know is, will my brain heal? Can I get better? Will I ever recover? Because I've been sick for a year now. As of March 15th is my COVID anniversary. And I want to know if I have hope of returning to my previous life or if this is a chronic illness. And that's really hard to live with. So that's my question.
David, do you have an answer to that?
Well, I think that no one has an answer to that right now in terms of this is a new condition. We are rapidly struggling to work out everything that we can about this novel condition. But if we can bring a little bit of comfort to Amy, we've actually just frozen a data set from our first 100 patients that have been through a rehabilitation protocol. We specially designed this rehabilitation protocol for COVID long haulers. And the good news is we're seeing around a 40% improvement in reported symptoms. The bad news is we're seeing this around 40% improvement after about 160 days in the rehabilitation program. So I think what everybody needs to hear at this point is that improvement is possible with careful rehabilitation, but we're looking at a very long road to complete recovery. We have had cases of complete recovery at this point, but these are individuals who have been consistently working with our rehabilitation program for, you know, more than 12 months. So I think that that is the time frame that we need to be thinking on. That's the scale that we need to be thinking on when we think about rehabilitation. I think that even then, there's no guarantee that everybody is going to feel the way they did pre-COVID. We still have so much learning to do before we can understand how everybody's going to respond to rehabilitation. And I think also government agencies, CDC, NIH, Social Security Administration need to brace for this, because from our data set, what we're seeing is that 60% of individuals who are coming to us for care, and we've managed around 950 cases at this stage, tell us that their employment status has changed. And so I think that we all need to be ready for a big influx in people's work status changing, their life status changing for a period of time. And we all need to be prepared with the best science and the best possible care coordination to make sure that all of these individuals who are feeling exactly like Amy is feeling, completely displaced, like they've lost control of their body, we need to all work together with a lot of compassion to bring them back.
Can you give me an idea about what rehab looks like?
Sure. So as I mentioned earlier, we have focused a lot of our attention on the idea that many of these symptoms are similar to what we see when people have a condition known as dysautonomia, the autonomic nervous system being thrown out of balance. And when you look into the literature surrounding how to rehabilitate individuals with dysautonomia, there are a number of behavioral interventions where we work around identifying each patient's specific triggers of severe symptoms and give them strategies to avoid those triggers. So to give a concrete example of that, some people will experience a severe attack of symptoms immediately after eating a big meal. That's because in many cases of dysautonomia, stretching out of the stomach will cause an autonomic response that makes them feel like they're about to faint. that their heart is beating rapidly in their chest, and it's incredibly unpleasant, and it can knock them off balance for the rest of the day. So in individuals who get triggered by large meals, of course, we have them working with a nutritionist to help them plan out smaller meals that aren't going to bring on these triggers. There are a diverse number of triggers that we could go through, but we won't because we got limited time. But the point is, the first thing we start with is, you currently feel like you're out of control, your body is out of control. Let's bring some normalcy and some sense to what you're experiencing. So for every identified trigger, we come up with a solution.
And the percentage of patients, you said, who actually are improved after your treatments?
So rather than looking at percentage of patients who are showing recovery, we were talking more about the average recovery in the group. And the average recovery in the group is around 35%.
That's very, very interesting. Walter, is there a certain demographic that seems to be hit harder by neurological symptoms after COVID?
There is certainly, from the reports that are out there, there are more females than males in most of the reports of people with suffering post-acute sequelae of COVID.
Mm-hmm. David, could there be a lot more people who are suffering symptoms out there and don't know that they have, that they're long haulers?
I think that certainly we could have a large number of people who are out there and just not feeling right after their COVID infection, and either, you know, don't realize that it's something that they can seek help over, or in fact, you know, don't feel safe seeing a physician to describe their symptoms. You know, a lot of what has been was happening early on in the pandemic, and is still happening, thankfully, to a lesser degree, is there's certainly a lot of medical gaslighting going on in this community. And so I think that right now the demographics may be skewed because we know that historically excluded groups will experience more medical gaslighting. So, you know, women, people of color, et cetera, people with disabilities. And so I think that there could very well be a number of individuals out there who are experiencing these symptoms, but simply don't want to go to the doctor and say, oh, I had COVID and now I'm feeling, here are some vague subjective symptoms that I'm experiencing. And because I think that they fear what comes next, which is the doctor saying, hey, this is just anxiety, or you're having a panic attack, go home.
Walter, I want to get a message in from another long hauler, Susan from Needham.
I am a COVID long hauler. I just passed the 1 year mark of being exposed to COVID on March 20th, 2020. My question is, I am wondering if there is any research being done on the effects of COVID on the hippocampus. I am losing my cognitive mapping, where I can be driving down the street or I go into a grocery store that I've shopped in for 30 years and I have absolutely no idea where I am. It's as if I have never been in that store in my life. And I know I am not the only one. I've read many articles of other people who are also experiencing these episodes of cognitive mapping loss. So I was wondering if there's anybody looking at that. Thank you.
Could it be cognitive memory loss?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the memory is what people are complaining about. Now, if you think about it, you know, if you have a fever and you have the flu, you're not thinking as quickly, your memory's not as good. We know there are so many things that can influence memory, and certainly fatigue, sleep, if you're having sleep trouble, and potentially even the effects of the virus. So we don't know is whether this is you know, an autoimmune reaction that's been set up by having the virus, whether it's a disturbed immune system. We don't actually even know if the virus is still hiding there somewhere, triggering these troubles. But the memory problems, the attention problems, concentration trouble, that is what you see in people who have numerous rheumatologic conditions, post-concussion. And so there's lots of factors that could be causing that. We have to kind of get at the bottom of it.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. I just have a couple of more questions. I'd like to get to them from our listeners. I want to talk about the vaccines and how they might interact with COVID long haulers, because I want to play a call that we got from Anne in San Diego. Anne suspects she had COVID in March 2020, but did not get tested, so she doesn't know for sure.
The worst symptoms were deep, very painful muscles. After about 8 months, I still couldn't lift either arm to the level of my shoulder. I had the Moderna vaccine starting in January, and it finished in February. And I had one in one arm and one in the other. And at that point, all of the pain went away.
Walter, this seems pretty bizarre, doesn't it? Do we know if the vaccine is altering people's long-haul symptoms?
You know, I think we've heard those type of stories multiple times. And so if that's true, I think that's fantastic, that there's some clue there to these symptoms if it goes away after the vaccine. Now, what's the clue? The obvious one is there's some virus still in the body, and the vaccination then, you know, revs up your immune system and gets rid of the virus. But there's lots of other possibilities. It could be the vaccine resets your immune system. There are also people who have, the symptoms have gone away, but then they come back 4 or 5 days later. So I think we need to get, you know, this is great. You know, you have to look around, listen to the patients, as David said, and they can provide the clues. But, you know, this is the one clue that seems worth following up in terms of studying people before and after they get vaccinated, and then see if there's a reaction to the vaccine that's related to improvement. That could help everybody with this condition. But I think at this point in time, we have to kind of get more kind of rigorous data to that point.
Well, in getting the data then, would you recommend that long haulers get vaccinated so maybe they could be tracked?
Oh, absolutely. I think that almost everybody should get vaccinated. The exclusion for vaccination are very almost non-existent.
I want to ask you both this question, starting with you, David. It seems like there are a lot of mysteries around long COVID. If you could get the answer to any piece of this puzzle that would really change how you do your job, what would you like to learn?
Well, this may sound very reductive and very simple, but leading right back to when I mentioned that word, the pathophysiology of long COVID, we are currently managing symptoms. We are currently using our best guess at rehabilitation approaches, and those rehabilitation approaches are working, albeit slowly. I think that we could just become so much more targeted, both with therapeutics and rehabilitation, if we understood why this is happening in the body. So, I mean, if I could snap my fingers and understand one thing, it would be what is happening in the body that is causing this physiological change that is leading to this incredibly debilitating, multi-system, multi-symptom condition. Once we understand why it's happening, then we can think about targeted treatments as opposed to more generalized treatments.
Walter, same question to you.
Well, I have the same answer with a different twist, and that is that what I would like to know is what's the difference between those people who have the same degree of illness from COVID, who get better quickly, versus those who don't get better for months and months. And I think this is the opportunity we have to get at that. I think that's going to shed a lot of light on this problem and potentially other, you know, conditions like ME/CFS.
I'd like to end with one question from Katie, or a statement and a question from Washington State.
Is this a life sentence? Because I got sick a year ago, and I was in New York City, and I moved myself across America. I got treatment in Seattle, and now I'm in Wenatchee, Washington, and I'm still doing miserable. So I'd just like to know, is there hope for us out there?
Research is hope. There's hope through research. We have to get to the bottom of it to help people. You can't lose hope.
I've never heard anybody, any researchers say they have enough money to do what they need to do. But I'm going to ask you, Walter, with this new cohesive approach, is there enough money being thrown at it to create this network that you're talking about?
Well, we don't throw money here at NIH.
Isn't that the truth?
Well, that's why I asked. I said, I've never heard a site to say I have enough money to do anything.
Point, yeah, well, Congress realized this was a problem, and they appropriated $1.15 billion for this problem. And that's really given us the chance to go at it in a big way. So this is a real substantial research initiative, thanks to the wisdom of Congress.
David, how do you answer that question for yourself?
I would agree. I've been absolutely overwhelmed by the responsiveness of the NIH, the CDC, the Social Security Administration reaching out to my team, asking for data, asking, you know, for anything that they can do to understand this problem and get at this problem. So, you know, I think that I've never seen this level of cooperation across health systems, across government agencies. I really hope that that continues. I really hope that we can all just, you know, make a concerted effort to work together to really unlock these puzzles so that individuals such as the last caller who are really concerned, is this a life sentence? We can give them some hope. You know, I totally agree with Walter. Where there's research, there's hope. You know, we're working as fast as we can. This is a brand new condition. And the more that we can all organize together and be collectivist in our approaches, the better chance we have to help these people out.
Well, I hope we have given some people some hope today. We've certainly given them a lot of information. And I want to thank both of you for taking extra time to be with us today. Dr. Walter Karashets, Director of the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke in Bethesda. Dr. David Putrino, Director of Rehabilitation Innovation for the Mount Sinai Health System in New York, New York. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to hear a longer version of this conversation, we had so much more to talk about, go to our website, sciencefriday.com/longhaulers. Charles Berquist is our director. Our producers are Christy Taylor, Katie Feather, and Kathleen Davis. Senior producer, Alexa Lim. Our contributing editor is John Dankosky. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. One last thing before we go. We're celebrating Citizen Science Month throughout April, and we've partnered with the Great Sunflower Project for a pollinator-palooza. Yeah, so find out more on our website, sciencefriday.com/citizenscience. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And yes, it's Friday. Best day of the week. We finally get to put the product of all our hard work onto the airwaves, the intertubes. It's almost time to relax a bit. And when I want to take my mind off an exhausting week, I turn, like many, I'm sure, to the restorative power of music. And sci-fi producer Christy Taylor agrees with me, right, Christy?
Absolutely, Ira. There's nothing I love more than settling down with a good piece of music after a hard day. And actually, I came with something to share with you, a piece of music that I've been listening to a lot lately.
That is nice. Relaxing. A little moody, maybe?
That's a piece called Valse Sentimentale, which means sentimental waltz, by the Russian composer Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky. I have another surprise for you, which is that is not a human pianist that you hear playing that music right now.
What is it? What is it? A Martian? Who's playing the music?
It's actually an AI named Audeo watching a video of a person, in this case a pianist named Paul Barton, trying to turn what it sees into the music that you're hearing right now.
Wait a minute. So AI is doing all these things with medicine and computers, and now it's making our music. Where will this end?
I mean, that's amazing, right? Though, doesn't that sound expressive and emotional and nuanced, kind of like a person having feelings as they play the piano?
Yeah, too much so for my taste, I think.
Well, this is all coming from work by Dr. Ellie Schliezerman, who is an assistant professor of applied mathematics and electrical and computer engineering at the University of Washington. He presented this musical research at a conference on machine learning last year. I heard it, I was intrigued, and I wanted to talk to him more about how and why, since that's a good question you ask, Ira, he decided to make this.
Christy, I am all ears. Get it? Music joke? Sorry, it's the weekend coming up.
The first thing I asked Dr. Schlesermann was just what was going on in that piece of music we just heard.
Odell can look at a silent performance video, learning from a top view camera of any piano piece, and then generate the music that corresponds to that performance. It's a computational system that has an input without any audio, just video frames. And the output of this computational system is a sound, an audio waveform that we can all hear and interpret.
So just to give our listeners a sense of what originally this piece might have sounded like, here's the actual human pianist, Paul Barton, playing that piece himself.
It's an amazing piece.
And then let's go back to the AI version from Audeo. I'm listening to the human versus the AI version, and I do hear some differences, but what are the important similarities in that for you?
First of all, we recognize that this is Val Sentimentale, right? And we also enjoy the music. So that's what we wanted to create. We wanted to see how a computational system will represent movements, something which is pretty mechanical, into sounds that we can interpret, we can enjoy, we can imagine along with the video stream how these two streams will join together into a beautiful piece. And the differences in terms of the generated output, of course, the computational system is not perfect and anyone can hear that. But also, like, each performance will be a different performance. If you'll take one musician, they will play it in one way. Another musician will play it in another way. So what goes into music that we hear and kind of have an interpretation of, that was the intention of our study, to really understand how we can frame it in a computational way.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to understand, too, your AI, Audeo, had never actually, quote, heard Vals Sentimentale before, right? It's generating it completely fresh based on the input it's seeing from the fingertips, right?
That's correct. Audeo was trained on data sets that are classical music, but also some modern music as well. What it tried to establish is the connection between the movements of fingers and the keyboard that it sees to how to translate them to music. And then it was able to generalize and to translate this information to new music. That's what we often do in AI systems. We train them on particular data sets, and then we see how they generalize, especially in such a task called an unsupervised task, where we don't tell the system what to do. It is supposed to generate the music eventually.
So Ellie, a thing I didn't realize before is that a synthesizer isn't just one generic thing. You can use a different synthesizer software to get a different sound. So here's a sample of Audeo using a slightly different synthesizer software to interpret the same video. That sounds so much cleaner to me, but it's also missing something, right?
Yes. It kind of sounds more mechanic, right? This is the interesting component of music. Music starts from the score sheet, and then the music theory, how to play an instrument, will also include how to move the hands correctly and position the hands and to perform all the notes and so on. So this is the music theory. But when you try to translate it to computational system, these rules are not necessarily the best way to represent the music or to let the computer to learn how to represent the music.
I must imagine that this work involves a lot of sitting at your computer and coding, but also listening to music, right? Is it pleasant or is it tedious?
Yeah, so initial outputs from Audeo weren't musical pieces that you would immediately recognize as music that would be played by a musician. And that's the challenge as well. So music is very sensitive. This is what we discovered in the beginning of the study. Even if we are making like very small mistakes, even if we are doing some of the phases in the computational system with more kind of noise or inaccuracies, we will eventually generate something that wouldn't sound like realistic music. And the challenge is really to see what are the components, what is this inner representation within an AI system that could enable such a transformation that will sound realistic to us and will capture all the components of music within it.
Have you talked to Paul Barton about how he feels? Like, is he worried that he's going to be replaced by an AI because you can replicate his music without hearing him play it?
I haven't talked with Paul about it, but Paul Barton is such a virtuoso. I don't think an AI system can replace Paul in terms of his skills. It's more about enabling ways of interacting with music and also interpreting music. Placing a camera on top of a piano, that could be like a pretty simple thing. But what could it allow us to do? So, for example, we could play the piano, but then hear a different output that is generated from the system that is powered by audio. For example, we could hear the same music as a violin or a koto instrument, for example. We could also get some cues from the system of how we are playing, are we playing in the right way, and so on. Beyond that, accessibility is a major issue. We are interacting quite a lot with different tools. One of them is the computer. We interact with the computational systems quite a lot, but with mechanical instruments like the piano or others, we really need to be like next to them, right? So in order to generate music. So how can we generate music and interact with music in a virtual environment? That's very interesting and compelling in terms of the implications of audio.
So if you can teach an AI to play the piano, can you teach it to play a different kind of instrument, like a flute or a violin, where you don't necessarily just plunk a finger on a key and have one set note, right? There's a lot more shifting around with other instruments. Can you still do something with that?
For some instruments, we think that we could do a similar setup. We chose the piano for several reasons. One of the reasons is the keyboard is well-defined. It has a defined number of keys. Putting a camera on top of a piano that doesn't move, it's a pretty easy task to do. And musicians like Paul Barton did that and provided to us this visual stream. But also, the piano is an interesting instrument in terms of being polyphonic. So it can create many, many tones and many sounds at the same time. This is what makes piano a unique instrument in terms of computational investigations. On one hand, the instrument is well-defined and we can monitor the activity, how the instrument is being played. But on the other hand, the output is so variable and so interesting. We can generate so many music outputs out of it that this was a challenge for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you play the piano yourself, Ellie?
I used to study piano when I was a child and liked it, but due to not having access to an instrument and honestly also the daunting amount of practice as a child, it's a difficult task, right? So like every day you need to play at least 1 hour. So this eventually made me stop taking lessons. I still have an urge to play the piano, and once in a while I would sit down and play a simple piece, and I would really enjoy that. And I think these experiences motivated me to think, like, why it is so challenging to interact with music and how we can make it easier and kind of like keep those experiences even with other systems like computational systems with the computer, iPad, or any other setup.
Well, I love that you found a way to be surrounded by music without having to practice all the time.
Well, practice is still needed.
Thank you so much for your time today, Ellie.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Ellie Schliesserman is an assistant professor of applied mathematics and electrical and computer engineering at the University of Washington in Seattle. I'm Christy Taylor.
Thank you, Christy. That was a truly harmonious story. Dare I say, it's intermission. And when we come back, the charismatic giraffe is suffering a silent extinction. We'll talk about it, everything you've ever wanted to know about giraffes. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. Ever heard a giraffe roundup? Very good. For the past several months, a daring and unprecedented rescue mission has been underway in western Kenya. Local conservationists have been slowly puzzling how to ferry 9 stranded giraffes trapped on a flooded peninsula back to the mainland. They rescued the most vulnerable first, forced to sedate them for a duration of the journey. But for others, they tried a less dramatic approach, coaxing the giraffe with food onto a wooden log barge. And this week, the last 4 giraffes will be moved to safety. A valiant months-long effort, all for 9 giraffes, but this small pod represents 1% of the total population of its species. Only 800 northern giraffes remain in Africa. My next guest calls this the silent extinction. Giraffe populations are plummeting, all while we haven't been paying attention. Dr. David O'Connor, conservation researcher and president of the nonprofit organization Save Giraffes Now. Dr. O'Connor, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much, Ira, and thanks so much for having us and for focusing on giraffe.
Give me an idea of what this looks like, the peninsula where the giraffe were stranded.
Yeah, so it was a peninsula going into Lake Baringo in western Kenya. It was about 100 acres in size, this peninsula. And, you know, nearly 10 years ago, 8 giraffes were brought to this peninsula to reintroduce them into the region after 70 years of being extinct there. And they were reintroduced to the peninsula because the community and the wildlife authorities thought that, you know, that's the best place we can reintroduce them. They'll be safe there. We can defend them from poachers there. And then as conditions improve, they can easily access the mainland. Well, unfortunately, the lake had other ideas and decided to rise about 40 to 50 feet, completely flooding the peninsula and creating this island that we're left with today.
Wow. You know, I didn't realize how few giraffes there were left.
Yeah. Unfortunately, when you put all the giraffes together in Africa, there's only about 100,000 left. That's our best estimate. And, you know, that sounds like a lot. But if you compare it to, say, elephants, there's about 400 to 500,000 elephants left. So, you know, there really are very, very few giraffes left. And of the 4 species, 3 are considered endangered or critically endangered. So we really do have to act now to try to save these giraffes across the continent.
Okay, you say that the giraffe are experiencing a silent extinction. Mm-hmm. What exactly do you mean by that?
It's really, as you said in your introduction, that, you know, unfortunately, they're slipping away, but they're not getting the attention. It's not really raising the alarm bells the way perhaps it should be in the public consciousness. You know, I think people are familiar with, you know, what's happening with rhino generally, or elephant, or even, you know, lions or panda. But, you know, giraffes are so famous, you know, and you see them in kids' books or on television or in cartoons, but nobody really knows what's happening with them in the wild.
Are there certain species of giraffe that are more in danger than others?
Yeah, the northern giraffe species that you mentioned are the most imperiled. And then the reticulated and the Maasai giraffe are also endangered. Thankfully, the giraffe across southern Africa, the southern giraffe, they're actually doing okay as a species, and their populations are stable. So, you know, conservation-wise, we're really focused on those 3 other species.
You talk about the articulated giraffe and the other species. I don't think most of us realize that giraffe can look different from one another.
Yeah, they can. And, you know, generally speaking, they look giraffe-ish, you know, with the long neck and the long legs. But yeah, you know, when you put them side by side, they're really quite different. And genetically speaking, the difference between them as a species are the same as a brown bear is from a polar bear, say.
Wow. Does that mean that they diverged from some common ancestry relatively recently?
It's actually further back than we think, because they, you know, they are quite distant, but some of them do still maintain the ability to hybridize and produce a hybrid calf. So they're, you know, they're not, you know, all that far back, but they did come from a common ancestor, and I think it was mostly geographical separation that sent them on their different species lines.
You said that we know very little about giraffe. Maybe it's easier to ask what we don't know about them.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And it's one of the reasons I got interested in giraffe, because we know so very little about them. You know, we don't know with great certainty their numbers. We have estimates, like I've said, but we don't know with great certainty. We don't really know where they are. Like, we don't know how many are left in Ethiopia or where they are in South Sudan or in Somalia, for instance. We don't know their home range sizes. We don't know their seasonal migration routes. We don't know their social structures in terms of how they herd together or even how they communicate. Do they communicate? They're largely silent. And I would argue we still don't know the reason why they have a long neck.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I've always wondered about that long neck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's that whole Lamarck thing about
right.
Giraffe had a long neck, right?
Yeah.
I also find it really interesting that they have only 7 vertebrae in their neck like we do, but they're much bigger vertebrae, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that bananas? I love that fact. They just have really, really big vertebrae. And, you know, they also have a really unique blood flow system, which I find fascinating. They're sort of like, to me, you know, like a carefully engineered race car or a Formula One car. Like, they're very precision engineered beings, you know, because sometimes, you know, when you stand up too quickly, sometimes we feel a bit woozy. Well, if you can imagine, you know, if you're drinking as a giraffe at the level of your feet and something startles you and you whip your head up through an arc of, you know, 19 feet, why don't they pass out every time they stand up straight?
Right, right, yeah.
So they have this unique blood flow system with sets of valves to stop, you know, the blood backflowing quickly or, you know, going all the way to their head and having a hemorrhage. So it's, you know, they have like compression socks basically built into their legs. I mean, they're absolutely fascinating. They're really, and they're the watchtowers of the savannah. You know, other species depend on them and will herd around them at the bottom of their feet, you know, because they'll be the first ones to see danger.
Wow. Can they use their necks aggressively or to fight with or fend off other animals that want to attack them?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ira, you laugh, you know, by fending off people, but I have been kicked by a giraffe and broke my ribs. So,
oh, is that right?
Yeah, they do fend off people too. Mostly they use their legs for defense against other species. Their kick can kill a lion, for instance, but for their necks, and that's one of the thoughts about how they got the long neck, is they use it in fights, either to gain a sort of hierarchy of dominance or also for access to females. And it's usually the males that fight. And what they do is they swing their heads like a mallet and bash each other on their sides with their heads. And, you know, they use their necks to sort of swing through that motion. And the sound of the impact, it's like this big doom, and you can feel it in your chest. So they really are hammering each other with their heads. It's quite a spectacle.
You know, we've been having fun and talking about how the giraffe use parts of their bodies, but the serious question about their extinction, I'm wondering whether we don't notice much why it's such a silent extinction, because we don't think of poachers, right, selling ivory and killing them for that reason.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it's, you know, and it's also a function of not many people are working on them or just watching them. So you also don't have many people, you don't have many eyes on them to kind of raise that alarm. But for giraffe, when it comes to poaching, they're not poached for those trophy items like rhino horn or ivory that we've heard about, but they're poached more for bushmeat, and it's mostly in country. And it's unfortunately when it gets to the scale of being commercialized, where you have people going out, you know, on motorbikes and gangs with automatic weapons, and the meat's being taken to commercial centers and being sold that way, that's when it's not sustainable, and the, you know, the population just gets hammered.
Tell me more about your nonprofit Save Giraffes Now. How many projects, how many savings, rescues have you had to do?
Yeah, so right now, Save Giraffes Now is working across 9 countries in Africa with partners, and we focus on 3 main priority areas that we think impact and help giraffe, you know, now. It's in our name. We really are action oriented. So we're very much focused on rescues and rewilding, as you say. We also focus on anti-poaching, which is hugely important. And then we focus on community-led projects where we're working with local communities to monitor giraffe. And then also we're setting up giraffe rescue centers for giraffe calves that have become orphaned. Either their parents or mother has been, you know, poached or killed, or they've become very far separated from the herd and they can't find their way back. So, you know, with this current reintroduction project off the island, it's right now we're moving 9 giraffe off the island, and we'll also reintroduce another, say, 12 back into this area to start this breeding population in the Ruco Conservancy, where they disappeared 70 years ago. But with the orphan program, you know, we're able to save and release back to the wild, you know, tens of giraffe. And we're growing that as in more country as resources allow.
So that program where you're rescuing the giraffes now because the lake was flooding, that has been successful.
Yeah, thankfully it has. There were 9 giraffe trapped on this island. And as of today, we have rescued 5 successfully. And there are 4 more left on the island that are actually being rescued this week. I was meant to be there, but with COVID restrictions in Kenya at the moment, I wasn't able to go. But the team on the ground there are excellent. So, you know, we're all watching our phones for updates from Kenya to see how that's going.
So what's the plan? Do you rescue them and you wait for the waters to recede and then put more giraffe back there?
Well, you know, that was our big problem, is how do you get the world's tallest animal off an island when it doesn't swim? You know, the lake levels at the time when we started this were rising about 6 inches a day. And there was one giraffe particularly that was trapped alone on this sliver of island that was really going to be flooded. So we had to move quite quickly. And so together with the community and the wildlife authorities and our partners, we created this raft. And we're actually sailing the giraffe off the island, if you can believe.
I'm trying to think that this giraffe, I'm thinking, is top heavy on a raft, right?
Yeah.
Well, what worse combination could you have?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But the community, they built this raft, which we've nicknamed the giraffe. And it's a real engineering marvel, actually. They put together 60 steel, basically oil drums together, and then put, you know, the planks and stuff on top of it. And create this very, very stable square base. And then we built up the sides, you know, about 10 feet so the giraffe don't, you know, go into the water. And it's been amazing. We've been taking the giraffe one by one off. Some, I'll admit, are better sailors than others. But it's been, you know, so far very, very successful. No giraffe have got injured. No people have got injured. And they've all joined up on the mainland together, forming a new herd.
So you sort of had to MacGyver the whole thing to create the raft.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're right. If you can imagine, you know, Ruco is very remote and, you know, you have to sail everything in by boat most of the times, you know, because the roads aren't passable in the rainy season, etc. And, you know, that the team there are just incredible, so resourceful and talented to be able to create this engineering marvel that's now saving these giraffes.
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios, talking with Dr. David O'Connor, president of Save Giraffes Now, and a researcher associated with the Smithsonian Institution. This is like, I've never heard of a giraffe rescue or the need to rescue giraffes. You were talking a bit before, people eat the giraffes. Is that the problem?
Yeah, in certain places. So, you know, there's 4 main reasons for the decline of giraffe across Africa. At the top of the list is loss of habitat and habitat degradation and fragmentation. And that affects so many species. Then there is, you know, prolonged droughts and the less dependable rains that are now we're seeing because of climate chaos and climate change. And then in certain countries in Africa, its poaching is very, very heavy and taking a very heavy toll on these giraffe. And it is for meat. And it's, you know, maybe if it was, you know, at a village or a family level, you know, where they really are desperate for protein, that might be, you know, sustainable. But when it's commercialized in these areas and where you have people coming in on motorbikes or with automatic weapons and just plowing down the giraffe and bringing the meat into town, into commercial centers, that's when you really, really see the populations going way down.
And is a giraffe called a pod instead of a herd? Is that what?
It's actually, believe it or not, called a tower.
That sounds right, a tower.
Yeah. Whoever came up with that deserves some kind of award, I think.
And what is a typical tower composed of? One male, many females? How does that work?
Well, as we were saying at the beginning, we don't know. We still don't know, because if you look at a giraffe tower, and say you start with, you know, five giraffe in this tower, it's not like a herd of sheep, say, where there's 10 sheep and they go around, they all stay together and that's it. That's the herd. In a tower, you'll start with five giraffe. Suddenly two might wander in out of nowhere and they join up for a while. Then one might move off somewhere else and go wander off into the distance. So they're not stable. They're a fission-fusion type dynamic, we call it. But mostly, I would say they're female-dominated, these towers. And you know, they come together and have semi-stable relationships, and then also for their calves. And then basically the mature males go from female tower to female tower to female tower, basically trying to get lucky, I think.
And when you bring in the giraffe, the tower, to the breeding area, that what used to be the peninsula now is the island, which will become a peninsula again, how do you know how many of what kind to bring in there?
Right. So we knew historically that this area of Kenya had a type of northern giraffe called the Rothschild giraffe, also known as the Nubian giraffe. So we knew that they were evolved for that area. And it was very much 70 years ago, the center of their range in Africa. And unfortunately, they were wiped out by poaching and being caught in human conflict over 70 years ago. And so we knew that it was Rothschilds that had to go back in. And with the Ruko Community Conservancy there, that's 44,000 acres. They were very keen to bring back giraffe to their land. And so we thought this is the perfect opportunity to get giraffe back in onto the mainland, off the island, and then, you know, also bring in some more to start a breeding population. And just saving these giraffe from the island are our first step.
Wow, this has been fascinating, Dr. O'Connor, for all of us. I learned so much about giraffes and about your rescue efforts. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. David O'Connor, conservation researcher, president of the nonprofit Save Giraffes Now. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's disease and a new study that links it to lifestyle and nutrition. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Alzheimer's disease is still such a mystery. There are still no known ways to stop this degenerative disease. Available drugs, well, they work only to slow symptoms, but there is a potentially fruitful area. Researchers have been investigating the connection between type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance, and Alzheimer's for decades. It's known, for example, that having diabetes elevates your risk of Alzheimer's. The question is, why? There is an intriguing clue. A team at Brigham Young University and Washington University in St. Louis found that brain cells in regions most affected by Alzheimer's seem to show impaired ability to metabolize sugars. Here's lead author Dr. Benjamin Bickman.
We identified every relevant gene involved in glucose metabolism in all of the different cells of the hippocampus, and every gene in every cell was compromised or significantly down.
This finding supports characterizing Alzheimer's as a metabolic disorder, suggesting that lifestyle or dietary changes may help prevent or treat Alzheimer's.
As the brain is becoming increasingly insulin resistant, it's becoming increasingly less able to get adequate glucose. So you end up in this sort of tragic scenario where the body is flush with glucose, but the brain can't use it.
Dr. Benjamin Bickman. Here to update and talk more about the research into Alzheimer's and blood sugar is Dr. Shannon McCauley, assistant professor of geriatric medicine. She studies the connection between Alzheimer's disease and type 2 diabetes at Wake Forest School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I should note, Dr. McCauley is not affiliated with the new research I just mentioned. Welcome back, Shannon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
First of all, what did this team look at in this new research? Can you fill us in on that?
Absolutely. So this team took postmortem brain samples and looked at how the genes change that really regulate brain metabolism in a few key regions in the brain. And I think what they found is that glucose, which is a fuel for our brain, was unbelievably impaired in the regions that are prone to Alzheimer's pathology, such as amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. And what they also found is it wasn't just the neurons getting sick. In fact, they found that oligodendrocytes, which are our myelinating cells of the brain, were the ones that seemed to be unbelievably impaired using their approach. So one, it really reinforces the idea that as we develop Alzheimer's disease, that metabolic dysfunction could be playing a causal role in this disease, but also that cell types in these brain regions vulnerable to Alzheimer's pathology are impacted.
Why couldn't those brain cells get the glucose they need?
So it's hard to know from this study and a rich literature over the last 20 years, whether it's the transport of glucose into the brain that's impaired, or whether there's an intrinsic deficit in these different cell types to use glucose properly. What we do know is that the regions that are prone to Alzheimer's disease have a really high reliance on glucose for fuel. They're very active regions, they're well-connected regions, and those network failures are typical of Alzheimer's disease. And so what this study really showed was that they do not process glucose correctly, and how much of that is a cause or an effect still needs to be parsed out with future studies.
And as someone who's looking for this connection between Alzheimer's and insulin resistance, what excites you about a study like this and why?
For a long time, individuals just thought that the misuse of fuel or the hypometabolism we see in Alzheimer's, which is a key feature that most people use with neuroimaging, was just because the neurons were dying or the neurons were dysfunctional. And what really excites me about this study is it's really showing that perhaps we don't need to focus as much on the neurons, but we need to look at the glia. The glia are the cells that support the neurons, but they're way more than that. So the oligodendrocytes are our myelinating cells, the astrocytes and the microglia have a very complex role in inflammation and just normal brain function. And I think what's really rich about this study is it shows that these other cell types are contributing actively to the energy deficit we see in Alzheimer's disease.
You know, I've heard years ago, people would talk about Alzheimer's as possibly being, quote, type 3 diabetes because of this insulin resistance, and the same sort of jargon gets thrown around with Alzheimer's this way. Could there be a connection like that?
Absolutely. And I think there's a couple things that happen with type 2 diabetes. So you have this peripheral insulin resistance that happens in your muscle, your fat, your liver, where your body just doesn't respond to high levels of blood sugar, and it becomes toxic to your body. The brain is a very interesting organ in how it uses energy, how it responds to insulin, and insulin serves kind of a double role. It's not only important for managing glucose, but it also seems to be somewhat of a trophic factor that supports synaptic health. And we know neurons need to fire to have proper brain function, and insulin really supports that both from a metabolic standpoint, but then from almost a synaptic plasticity standpoint. And I think that there's a lot of information coming out that is getting at the core of what insulin resistance in the brain means. What does this mean in the context of Alzheimer's? And maybe it could be something we could target either pharmacologically or through lifestyle interventions.
You know, the authors are quoted in a press release saying that, quote, because the average person is eating insulin-spiking food so frequently, I look at these findings as a problem we've created and that we're making worse, unquote. Is it too simple to say that eating differently could solve Alzheimer's?
No, I don't think it's too simple per se. And I'll qualify by saying that I don't know that changing our diet is going to ward off all the aspects of Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is really the confluence of many different mechanisms over a lifetime. But what I will say is that bad eating habits, poor sleep, inactivity all comes down to the fact that we're not taking in energy properly or using energy properly. And this is really targeting these key networks in our brain to wear them out. So I do think that lifestyle modifications can all kind of keep these networks healthier longer. And if nothing else, increase our quality of life so we can age in a healthy way.
You know, what I have not heard you say, and what I have not heard from reading the research we're talking about, is the word plaques. And I mean, that's all we hear about Alzheimer's, is clearing the plaques in the brain. Is that not necessary?
So you can't have Alzheimer's disease with our current definition without considering amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. At autopsy, that's how we diagnose Alzheimer's disease. There is a lot of work, including work from my own lab, that has shown that if you have high glucose levels or hyperglycemia, this makes more amyloid beta and pushes the formation of amyloid plaques. So one way that poor diet can be linked to poor brain health is through generating too much A-beta and forming too much amyloid plaques. But the thing is that clearing amyloid plaques is insufficient for solving the complexity of Alzheimer's disease. And again, one of the things that's coming out with a lot of work nowadays is that what's the role of glia? What are the astrocytes, the microglia, and the oligodendrocytes doing to contribute to this? And those cell types are very reliant on glucose. They have a lot of different roles. And so it could be that those cells are the ones that really are driving this metabolic phenotype. And it might be if we can get those cells to respond better, you might not have as many amyloid plaques or neurofibrillary tangles.
You're of the opinion then that if we follow this metabolism road, we might get some really good results about understanding Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. And I think you can see that with, again, lifestyle interventions, as well as some clinical trials that are repurposing diabetic medications like metformin. Metformin is used to treat type 2 diabetes, but it's also being looked as potentially having a helpful role in Alzheimer's disease. And I think that there's a lot of great medicines out there that people are taking that could help or hinder the development of Alzheimer's disease. And this is an avenue that we need to investigate further. I think we definitely have realized that removing amyloid plaques is not going to be our cure-all for Alzheimer's. And so I really appreciate the NIH's investment in diverse approaches. There's a lot where we're using genetic studies to drive some new avenues into neuroinflammation and what the microglia and astrocytes are doing. So I think that we're going to see a lot of really innovative approaches to treating Alzheimer's disease in the next 5 to 10 years.
Dr. McCauley, thank you for this really informative discussion.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Shannon McCauley, an assistant professor of geriatric medicine, she studies the connection between Alzheimer's disease and type 2 diabetes at Wake Forest School of Medicine, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Don't you love to watch a mime? When you watch a mime, you know, someone seemingly pulling an invisible rope or running into an invisible wall, you're tricked into visualizing something that isn't there. But why does it work so magically? Is it all in the mime or all in the mind? That was the question my next guest set out to study in the science of miming. Dr. Chaz Firestone is an assistant professor of psychological and brain sciences and director of the Perception and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you, Ira.
So what did you discover? How is the mind helping you see what's not really there?
Well, what we were interested to know in our study is not just whether you infer the presence of objects that mimes create, but how. What kind of process in your mind is responsible for giving rise to those impressions you get when a mime seems to be, you know, trapped in a box or pulling a rope? So, for example, right now, you know, you're understanding the words I'm saying. And if I were to ask you, hey, Ira, could you stop understanding English? You know, stop understanding the words I'm saying. That's not something that you can do. Just like you can't mentally command your body to stop digesting food or to stop sweating when it's hot or something like that. And so what we wanted to know is when your mind decides for you that there must be some invisible rope or box or wall, is it more like understanding English? Is it more like something that happens automatically? Or is it more like something that you can control?
This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. And so you started doing some experiments. Please describe them for us.
So what we did is we set up some conditions where we showed people videos of someone, it happened to be me actually, interacting with some invisible objects. And we asked whether the influence that those videos has on people is automatic, whether people can't help but make the inferences that the actor who's interacting with the invisible surfaces seems to be wanting them to make. And then after people watched these videos, what we had happen was a line would appear on the screen in front of them, and they would just have to tell us what the orientation of the line was. So it could either be a vertical line or a horizontal line. And the idea is that sometimes the subject would see the actor step on an invisible box, which has a kind of like horizontal surface. And sometimes they would see the actor bump into an invisible wall, which has a vertical surface. And sometimes after seeing the actor bump into the invisible wall, a vertical line would appear, just like the wall, but sometimes a horizontal line would appear. And your job is just to tell us what the orientation of the line is. Forget about the guy who ran into the wall in the box. Just tell us, was the line that showed up horizontal or was the line that showed up vertical? So it turns out that you're faster to say that a horizontal line is horizontal if just before it, you saw a person interact with a horizontal surface like a box. And you're slower to say it's horizontal if you first saw an actor interact with a vertical surface and vice versa. And so in other words, you can't even inhibit your own mind's inclination to create for you the impressions of these surfaces.
What if you happen to have a mime? I'm not talking about you personally. If your mime was not really good, does the brain still help you to see the object?
I think it's the case that a mime does have to be pretty compelling in order to make you experience these objects. And one way that maybe we can see this for ourselves is just maybe you've ever tried to do this, you know, at a party or something. Hey, look at me. I'm pretending to be a mime. And how impressive are we when we do this?
Not very impressive. Yes.
Not so good. And so just like we might fail to, you know, impress our party guests if we ever would try this as like, you know, just for fun. There's a kind of a sweet spot or tipping point where the interaction with this invisible surface really does have to be sufficiently realistic in order for your mind to do this automatically.
You know, this reminds me of a famous experiment about colors and words. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do know what you're talking about. This is a beautiful and classic experiment. The effect you're referring to is called the Stroop effect. The way that the Stroop effect works is you're going to be shown a word, and the word is going to appear written in an ink of a certain color. And your job is just to name the color of the ink and forget what the word says. So for example, maybe you'll see the word red written in red ink, but maybe you'll see the word red written in blue ink. And the Stroop effect is the finding that if you ask someone to just report the color of the ink and not pay attention to the meaning of the word, they have a hard time doing that. So it's hard to say the word blue when the word red is written in blue ink. It's harder to do that than when the word red is written in red ink. And our study is kind of capitalizing on that similar sort of congruence and incongruence, that match and mismatch, where it's easy to report the orientation of the line when it matches the invisible surface that you've just seen. And it's harder to do it when it doesn't. And so just like in the Stroop effect, we learned that reading is automatic in a certain way. You can't help but read the words that are in front of you. We learned something similar about miming in our study. We learned that you can't help but infer the surfaces that a person is portraying for you with their behavior.
And this is because we have so many life experiences, I would imagine. We know how things should be.
To be honest, it's not something that we actually know the answer to. So here's one possibility. It's possible that over the course of your life, kind of like you just said, you have experience seeing how objects interact with one another, and you start to learn regularities about how that's true, and then you come to form expectations about those regularities, say, as a mature adult. But it's also possible that this kind of knowledge is built into you, that even as a young baby, as an infant who can't even speak yet, you might be sensitive to this kind of thing. And in fact, a really interesting research direction that we could take is to ask whether an infant shows something similar like this. Does an infant get surprised if someone seems to bump into something that the infant can't see? And if they do, then that might tell us that actually this knowledge is actually a lot more primitive than you might imagine, not something you had to acquire over the course of your life, but something that might actually be kind of built into who you are.
Yeah, that would be a very interesting experiment. I'd like you to do that for us, would you please?
I'd love to. In fact, you know, I'm recently the father of a new baby, so maybe I'll try it on him.
And you can tell us when you come back next time. How about that?
Fantastic.
Dr. Chas Firestone, Assistant Professor of Psychological and Brain Sciences and Director of the Perception and Mind Lab at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks. It was great to be with you.
That's about all the time we have for this hour. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. And on the Science Friday Vox Pop app this week, Earth Day is right around the corner. How do you plan to celebrate? Tell us about it. That's on the SciFry Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.